Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 15th of December. And we have a lot to talk about the first hour of our program today. Professor Larry Jacobs is going to be joining us, Chair of Political Studies and Director of the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance at the Hubert H. Humphrey Institute and Department of Political Science at the University of Minnesota. We'll be looking at, there is news today that the president has called all the Senate Democrats to the White House to talk about health care reform. And evidently, Senator Joe Lieberman has had his way, and the buy-in to Medicare for people who are 55 to 64 looks like it's off the table. We'll talk about that the first part of our program today, because we've been talking about healthcare so often. Professor Jacobs is going to be leading a course with Vice President Mondale this spring at the University of Minnesota, Great Debates of Our Time, the U.S. Policy and Politics. It's going to look at America's constitutional crises as presidents have struggled to balance national security with the country's laws and values. So we'll be talking about that course as well. There's just a lot to discuss here. Professor Jacobs has written extensively on healthcare reform and on income inequality, with the news that people are having a real struggle with jobs. The New York Times had a front page story today. The poll reveals depth and trauma of joblessness in the United States. We'll talk about that with Larry and many other topics. Our phone number, as always, is 800-486-8655. There's a gentleman outside my window who's cleaning the windows, and we're on the seventh floor, and he just went down to the sixth floor, or I would have had a hard time with this interview because that makes me nervous. How do people do those jobs? We should talk to people who do jobs like that for some show. Are you brave enough to do that? Did I give you the number? 800-486-8655. And if you would like to send an email, you can do that. It is talk@WPR.org. talk@WPR.org. Professor Jacobs, thank you so much for being with us.
Good to be with you again.
Yeah, we were up in your neck of the woods. My son was looking at the University of Minnesota, so we had quite a tour of Minneapolis and the University of Minnesota over the weekend. It was great. It's a beautiful school.
Yeah. I'm glad you enjoyed it. It's we've been doing a lot of building here.
Yes.
And we have a brand new stadium in the middle of our campus, which everyone's excited about. So, you know, there's a lot going on in Twin Cities.
Yeah, they're good. It was a good trip. Let's start, if you don't mind, with Joe Lieberman. Headline story today from Huffington Post: Lieberman wins Medicare compromise on the chopping block. A couple questions, because I wonder about the power that Senator Lieberman has. What's he doing here? And it becomes something that really changes what health care reform was going to be for him to not vote for this and to take out that provision.
Well, the key thing to remember is that we don't just have majority rule in the United States Congress. It's not just 51 votes that wins. In the Senate, as you and your listeners know, you need 60 votes. So what that means is that 59th or 60th vote has enormous, some would say, disproportionate power.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, you know, the most conservative senator in that coalition is able to exercise a veto, because without Lieberman, there is no legislation. And so the Democrats in the White House are now faced with this, you know, uncomfortable choice. Basically, do they scale back or do they take nothing? And to be honest, the Democrats have been in this position before and taken nothing. So it's possible things will fall apart and nothing will happen. My hunch, though, is that the White House needs something to pass here, and that most Democrats in the Senate are going to be furious at Lieberman, but realize that what Lieberman is signing on to still represents probably the most extensive social welfare reform since the New Deal.
Right. Do you have any idea, from reports I was seeing on TV last night, the reports indicated that he had a completely different position on this some 3 months ago. In fact, he talked about being able to buy into Medicare. What do you think might be going on? And I understand also that his fellow senators thought early as last week that he was still on board with all this.
There's a parlor game going on in Washington called "What is Lieberman up to?" And I don't think anyone, maybe not even Senator Lieberman, has a handle on it. You know, there's been some speculation that as he thinks about running for re-election, that he may be tacking towards a more kind of moderate Republican position. And if you look at the last election, he had a third of Democrats voting for him, and then did much better among independents and Republicans. So he may be kind of tacking back to kind of a moderate Republican position, thinking about how he's going to get elected with what will probably be a pretty significant challenge from a Democratic Party.
I would imagine. I would imagine a very significant challenge if he has his way with this bill. You have talked and you've written extensively about health care reform. Is there, do you think, any legislation that would overhaul the health care system that could win broad support? And let me ask that in two parts, A, among members of Congress, and B, among members of the American public.
Well, no. I guess I don't. You know, in Washington today, we are seeing the two parties as polarized as at any point, perhaps a century. And so while most Americans would like to see the Democrats, Republicans working together, you know, that's frankly a fantasy. What we're seeing is that the two parties are ginned up by their party base and their contributors and their leaders to move to the extremes. And, you know, you can go back and look at some of the policies George Bush put forward that were pretty similar to Democratic positions. And you saw the Democrats, you know, fleeing into opposition. You know, Barack Obama is seeing something pretty similar now. There, you know, probably a good part of this bill that's being put through, Republicans have been part of the thinking and the development of that policy. Insurance market reforms, you know, this is something that both parties largely support. But what's happened is the polarization between both parties is just, it is a fixed feature. And that tends to activate a real polarization within the general public.
Yes. It is interesting, isn't it, Professor Jacobs, that we have spent years talking about problems with the healthcare system, talking with Republicans and Democrats and small business owners, particularly so many people who have agreed that the system needs some kind of overhaul. And we've talked about it so long, and yet we're getting some kind of change here. But the polarization is there again, where it seems to me as though it wasn't some time ago, that it would come, when it comes down to the crunch, you've got people entrenched in their party ideas about this issue.
Absolutely. And there is a fundamental divide now between Democrats who are more comfortable with expanded government and a ferocious opposition among Republicans to expanded government. And, you know, almost any approach you're going to take, it's going to change the role of government, you know, if the Democrats are in power. Now, I think you're absolutely right that there is almost a consensus that the healthcare system we have now is broken. Most people agree that it's too expensive, and most people agree that access ought to be expanded. And I think that's kind of an untold story here, that you're seeing Republicans now acknowledging that more Americans should have health insurance access. But the problem comes in how you implement it. And I've been absolutely fascinated on this issue of cost control to see this consensus across party lines, across America, that we spend too much, and then every one of the proposals that that we've been talking about for literally decades for controlling health care costs, they come up, you know, for public debate and votes in Congress, and then you see opposition, and it leaves me wondering, at least, how can we have consensus on the general idea of controlling health care costs and such strong opposition to any specific step that would actually control costs?
What do you think is going to happen? What do you think is happening right now with the president and the Democratic members of the Senate?
Well, they're looking for the 60 votes, and so they are going to cave in to Senator Lieberman, and it's not a sign of weakness or, you know, lack of guts or those sort of, you know, thinking. It's really just a 60-vote count, and they need Lieberman's vote. They appear to have been unable to win the vote of Senator Snow, Olympia Snow from Maine, who had voted in the Senate Finance Committee for another reform proposal. So they're going to have to, you know, give up the Medicare buy-in, which was an option for those who were as young as 55 to buy in to Medicare. They're probably going to have to give up some other provisions to kind of make this a less expansive bill. But they will get very significant legislation. And when you look at the guts of what's being put forward, this is a starting point. And the conservatives are much more alert to this than liberals. Liberals look at what's excluded. But if you read the National Review and other conservative publications, and you listen to conservatives, what they say is, and I think they're right, that in the coming years, this will be built on. And so it's kind of a beginning of an entirely new process that will play out in the decades to come.
Mm-hmm. And tell me what's entirely, the major parts that are entirely new about this.
Well, there are three that I would single out.
All right.
One is that every American is going to be required to get health insurance. And, you know, you go back and forth, is it 94 or 98%? But the reality is there will now be a federal law saying you have to have health insurance. And over time, that is going to put a tremendous kind of pressure on both government and individuals to get coverage. Secondly, the government stepping up to the plate saying they're going to provide subsidies for those who are unable to afford that health insurance. Now, I would assume, based on having studied government for a long time, that those subsidies will be expanded in the coming years. And frankly, it'll be done by Democrats and Republicans who are seeking to address complaints and concerns and hardship among their constituents. So we've got this requirement by the government that you have health insurance. We've got the government stepping forward with subsidies that will probably be expanded. And the third part is that the insurance marketplace is about to be transformed. There's going to be a whole new set of prohibitions, and there will be various government efforts to facilitate more competition among health insurers so that the individual and the uninsured have a bit more leverage in the marketplace.
The problem with expanding Medicare, Lieberman's problems with it, Senate Republicans' problems with it, would be what? That it expands the role of government too much, that it's more socialism, which Medicare is in a way. It will add to the deficit. It won't give doctors enough money for reimbursement. What is the problem with that? Because people tend to like Medicare.
They do, and you've just ticked off all the reasons, though, that you see this opposition. And we can go through each one of them. Just on principle, there are a lot of Republicans who are concerned about expanding Medicare on a volunteer basis to those who are 55 because they assume this is the first step down a road in which you'll be 55 and then you start moving it up for kids up to about the age of 18. And to be honest, this has been the strategy of Medicare since its first inception as an idea back in the 1950s, was that it would be kind of an incremental expansion by population. And Republicans know this, and frankly, that's why the Democrats are supporting it, because they see it as a foot in the door. There is also concern among healthcare providers, hospitals in particular, that the Medicare reimbursement rate is lower than what they can get in the private sector. And this is one of the good stories about Medicare, that they have been able to hold the increase in healthcare spending lower than the increase we've seen in the private sector because of a payment system that's got some real teeth. Obviously, the hospitals and doctors don't want to see their pay going down, so they worry about that. Now, the last part is, this sense of what's coming down the road. And I think there are a lot of Republicans who are worried that, this is just the beginning, and it's going to end up with a single-payer system.
We welcome phone calls. We have many areas. I have a feeling that we could spend the whole hour on what's happening with health care reform and Senator Lieberman's winning a battle here. But we're also going to talk about joblessness. I'm interested in speaking with Professor Jacobs about the course he'll be teaching with Walter Mondale coming up this spring at the University of Minnesota. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, and the email address here, talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The second hour of our program this Tuesday, the author of Eating Animals. Let's go to phone calls. Mike from South Milwaukee, our first caller. Hi, Mike.
Hello.
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 Yeah, we can hear you.
Okay, I'm a retired physician, so I speak with some personal involvement in the medical system. First of all, this reform that's being discussed is not real reform. Anyway, it's not going to reduce cost as it should. We spend $2.4 trillion. We should be spending about $1.6 to $1.8 trillion. We spend way too much money, and we don't cover everybody. The other point that I have is the problem with is Joe Lieberman threatening to filibuster. We have a spineless president. A president with spine, like Roosevelt, would say, go ahead, Joe, filibuster. He would be made the object of scorn of the entire country as the person who's held up health care reform in this country. If we had a president who just faced Republicans and said, okay, I don't have 60 votes, you people are going to block it, and America is not going to have health care reform because you're going to filibuster, go ahead and filibuster. Joe Lieberman is a stooge of the insurance industry in the state of Connecticut. That's my comment.
All right, Mike. Thanks very much for the call. Professor Jacobs.
I love it. You know, there are a couple things. One is that, you know, on this Lieberman issue, there's no doubt that Lieberman, I think, is maximizing his leverage as a 60th vote. If you're that 60-vote person, you're the pivot in whether things are passed or not. And frankly, there are a lot of Republicans who are still steaming because there were a few Republicans who forced President Bush to scale back his tax cuts because they wouldn't go along. Both parties use this mechanism. Now, you know, I understand the sentiment that, you know, if Barack Obama would only put the screws and kind of put the national spotlight on Lieberman, it would work. But, you know, frankly, the history in that is not a good one. What is more likely to happen is Lieberman would dig in his heels more. And remember, Joe Lieberman's election was done over the opposition Democratic Party. I do not think that would be successful. FDR, fabulously effective president, and he decided not to push health reform, even though it was recommended by his advisors, because he didn't think it would pass. So, you know, this kind of political calculation, it's part of the process, and it's frankly the way in which we come to decisions on very emotional, divisive issues. Both parties engage in it. In terms of real health care reform, you know, I would say it's been discussed, and it's definitely been voted on, and there have been some very powerful ideas been put forward, including creating an independent commission on Medicare spending, this idea of taxing the more comprehensive health insurance plans, the so-called Cadillac plans. Both of them have been either shot down or gutted. And there have been a number of other ideas, comparative effectiveness or evidence-based medicine that folks have been talking about for decades, you know, just got a black eye, you know, perhaps unfairly because of the mammogram controversy. And you know, so these ideas are being talked about. My hunch is that they've been watered down now, but they will come back because they are the way in which all other countries have controlled health care costs, and it's the way these are the ways in which we've controlled Medicare costs, at least in terms of their increases.
What do you think about Mike's comments that the president has been rather spineless about this? We talked about this some yesterday, that if he had come out very strongly and said, this is my bottom line on health care, now go and work it out.
Show me the history of that ever working. I understand the sentiment, and I know people feel like the president can dictate what happens in Washington, but frankly, it's an illusion. It is just not what happens. Every member of Congress is elected on their own. The president, this is not a parliamentary system where if you go against the president, he can get you fired. And in Lieberman's case, he was literally elected by Republicans. Remember, he was unseated as the sitting, you know, as a Democratic Party representative. President Obama has very little leverage over him. And frankly, Democrats should be happy to have his support for a scaled-back version. So, I don't think President Obama can do a whole lot more. You know, he can use persuasion, he can use these press conferences to keep the heat on, but he cannot make any member of Congress do anything, and certainly not Joe Lieberman.
What about LBJ?
Well, you know, You know, you kind of go through the great LBJ moments on civil rights legislation, Medicare passed under LBJ. In each one of those cases, it was being pushed from Congress. And you saw the president often belatedly coming in behind and supporting it. There's a lot of talk about the so-called LBJ treatment, and we've got tapes of him doing it. And, you know, frankly, it's got a bit of a mixed record. It had effects in some cases, but in other cases he really alienated people, or he was exercising his magic and people were already leaning in his direction. I'm not saying that presidential persuasion here and there doesn't work. It's just as a tool, and particularly as a tool for a guy like Lieberman, who, again, was elected by Republicans, it's overstated.
Thanks, Mike, for your call. Jeff from Winneconne is next. Hi, Jeff.
Good morning.
Hello.
I don't understand how, you know, the Republicans, it just seems like they're throwing up a bunch of smoke and mirrors to make it look like there's a whole pile of Republicans there. Democrats have the House, they have the Senate. You know, what is going on here? I mean, you know, all these Republicans whining, they're still whining, you know, about losing, you know. And I'm just so sick of hearing this, you know, that I can't understand how they can even get a vote, you know. And Lieberman, you know, he's definitely a Republican. Do you think those people are actually going to get back in 2010? You know, everyone knows what's going on here. I think the general American public is not stupid.
No, I agree that the public is not stupid. I do, you know, if you look at the polls over the last few months in particular, Americans have become a lot more anxious and, you know, ambivalent or opposed to health reform. And, you know, I think there are a number of reasons for that. But I think there will be Republicans who are going to win the midterm election because of a backlash against the Democrats. Now, it's important to understand that backlash. I think part of the backlash is a sense that Democrats may have gone too far. President Obama may have bitten off too much. But there will also be Democrats, perhaps like Jeff, who are just frustrated that the Democrats haven't delivered more, and delivered more for people who are unemployed and uninsured and really hurting at this moment.
And people ask, didn't we elect a Democratic House, Senate, and President to do more?
Yes, and, you know, it's part of the curse or the blessing, depending where you are, of the system of government we have that James Madison and the others put into place. Our system of government is based on making it very difficult to get much done. And when they were kind of, you know, putting the wires together for our form of government, they definitely wired things to create deadlock and division and all sorts of obstacles. And it slowed down both Democrats in this case. But again, if you look back to the Republican era and you look at what conservatives say, they're furious at George Bush for not delivering more for conservatives. They felt that he really was an imposter, spent too much money, allowed government to grow too much. So this system of government is really, it's a real bear. And even when you get these tremendous majorities, in this case for Democrats, they find it difficult to move legislation. But as I said at the outset, in this case, the majorities are large enough that they're on the cusp of passing maybe the largest social welfare reform since the New Deal.
Thanks, Jeff, for the call. We go next to Joe. Hi, Joe. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I guess I was going to jump on the Lieberman bashing bandwagon as well this morning.
Okay.
And I mean, I guess I would like to see that. I know I'm just looking at an article here on the website that says, you know, Connecticut has the highest concentration of insurance jobs with 64,000 as of June 2009. And I also have read or seen somewhere in the past that his wife has direct ties to the health insurance industry. I don't know if she works for one of them or is a lobbyist or what, but anyway, I mean, and I'm understanding what your guest is saying in regard to, you know, that's how the system works and all that. I guess I'd like to, you know, just say that it's like, you know, and I saw the article this morning. They played the tape where 3 months ago Lieberman was having an interview and saying, you know, I'd like to, you know, see an expansion of Medicare, you know, basically what they said. So So somewhere, some between that 3 months ago and this, you know, he's either, you know, gotten in the pockets of the insurance company or whatever, and basically, and is now is calling the shots for the whole deal. And it's unfortunate that this one person can, you know, dictate the whole thing. And he's, you know, he's flip-flopped so much, you know, nobody knows which side he's on anymore, I don't think, except his own.
Professor?
Well, you know, as I said, he's the 60th vote at this point. And unless they can, you know, the Democrats in the Senate can bring on Republican Senator Snow or maybe Senator Collins, who's also from Maine, they're stuck with Lieberman, and they're going to have to appease him. You know, it's understandably frustrating. The one thing I would point out with regard to Joe's comment is, of course, every member of Congress is going to defend their constituents back home. And I realize that the health insurance industry is reviled at this point, but those are real jobs. And I can tell you, you know, take Minnesota, we've got our senators fighting a tax that would be put on medical device companies, which are an important part of the Minnesota economy. Every senator is going to do that for their constituents. Perhaps that's what Senator Lieberman is doing, but frankly, it's entirely legitimate.
Mm-hmm. I want to spend a little bit of time, and people can talk about Lieberman and health care reform, too. We're not off this topic. We're just going to move to another topic for a moment. And that concerns, I know you've written extensively a book about income inequality, and I'd like to spend a moment here talking about joblessness, because it seems to me as though this is a huge story right now in the country. The New York Times had a very disturbing front page story today about the number of people who have forsaken trips to the doctor because they don't have any money. They've asked for money from friends. They've cut back on medical treatments. They're suffering from depression and from anxiety. And we're talking about a fairly substantial portion of the American population right now. It seems to me as though it would behoove the president to really tackle this issue. I'm wondering what your thoughts are about those who have, and all of this is coupled with $30 million bonuses on Wall Street. Something is amiss.
Well, I think there's no doubt that the White House is on the wrong side of the popular sentiment at this point. There is a populist backlash against the rescue of Wall Street, which is now turned around and making tremendous profits and bonuses. You've seen the auto industry, showing some life, and they were the beneficiary of the bailout. And then you've got the rising number of unemployed and people who are suffering. If your listeners who haven't seen this New York Times story, it's really worth looking at. I'm someone who studies this, but these are really sobering numbers. 26%, according to the story, report that they've been threatened with eviction or foreclosure, have actually lost their homes.
Mm.
So this is a pretty dire moment, I think for the White House, they're caught in a kind of a pincer action. On the one hand, there's rising rage at this imbalance and help for the powerful and less help for those who are struggling. On the other hand, Americans are increasingly alarmed at the growing budget deficit and where we're going to get the money to pay for new benefits. So, how do you put more money into helping the unemployed and those who are hurting, at the same time to bring those budget deficits under control? The White House wants to say it can do both by really tackling the budget deficit as we move into next year and the economy starts to rebound and tax revenues start to roll in, while still providing some help for those who are unemployed. But frankly, they're in a very bad political position, and I think they're a little tone deaf in how they've responded to this.
Plus, they're sending so many more troops to Afghanistan, which isn't cheap.
Right, and this is, we saw this in Vietnam with the last time the Democrats really were in a powerful position, where John Kennedy and particularly Lyndon Johnson were engaged in the Great Society, passing Medicare, putting money in education and the environment. And at the same time, they increased the troops in Vietnam from about 10,000 to over 500,000. And you had all this money going into guns. There was less money to go into the butter. And it split the Democratic Party for almost three decades.
Back to phone calls. Beth from Oregon. Hi, Beth.
Hi. I originally called in to vent about Lieberman, but the professor's long historical view relaxed me somewhat. So I have a different but related question. We're in a period where there's tremendous anger. You just touched on it with respect to the economic situation. There's real anger. And you see these populist, some might call it demagogic, movements on the right and the left, and you see this inability to govern in the center. And I'm wondering what the professor's long view prognosis is with respect to the stability of our form of government. I see it as a very dangerous time. And I look back, you know, to the 30s historically and where there were similar divisions. But it seems, maybe because I'm living through it, it just seems different now. And I'm wondering if there should be some concern among the great middle of us that our government's sort of spinning out of control and is in danger of being taken over by very divisive, very nasty populist, not in a good way, populist movements.
Beth, that is a great question. And for anyone like me who kind of studies this, it's just the issue that I think people need to think about. It's really the question of our time. What I would say about that is I think we're coming out of the woods. Back at the beginning of this year, it was like you were a submarine and it was going deeper and deeper, and you could hear the screws starting to pop and the water starting to rush in to the submarine. We had really a free fall in our financial system. We were losing jobs at 500,000 or 600,000 a month, and there were no kind of plans on the shelf. We were in new territory. And that situation is now stabilized, and we've seen, I think, pretty good responses from Washington for the most part in keeping the economic system but also the political system moving forward. Remember, I think historians will remember this, George Bush was, in his last month in office, pushed through the rescue, the TARP money, and he pushed through the funds for the auto industry. So there was, there was a bit more kind of collaboration across party lines on that. And here's what I take hope in. When I look at kind of core public preferences about providing health care to everyone, health insurance to everyone, or providing education or job retraining for those who need it, I see majorities of Democrats and Republicans agreeing to that. Now, when you get proposals in Washington, you get the two parties, poking each other in the eye, some of that disappears. But there is a vital center in America that is pragmatic and realizes what needs to be done. And that's a check on one party, the Republican Party. On the other hand, there is a kind of uneasiness and anxiety about too much government. And frankly, it's not just Republicans who share it. You see Democrats also very supportive of a kind of a moderate government role and much more supportive of individuals taking the initiative and being responsible for themselves. That's a pretty broad, kind of base for this country to operate. And I think that vital center is still alive in America.
Thank you very much, Beth, for your call. Alan is next from Madison. Hi, Alan.
Hi. Your guest says that the Democratic strategy in this and what they're going for in these bills is eventually that this could lead to a single payer system. I don't see how that's possible when it looks like we're getting a mandated taxpayer supported or mandated taxpayer money going to the insurance companies who have already spent millions of dollars lobbying Congress to get the kind of bills or so-called reforms that they want. So with all this money going into the insurance companies and the lobbying and the money-supported political system that we have, how can that possibly lead to a single-payer system?
Thank you, Alan. I'm sorry for not giving short answers.
It's okay. We have an hour.
You know, I take an historical perspective on this, and I've studied and written about health reform in a variety of different countries. And let me give you an example of how I see this. I see this through the lens of 4, 5, 6 decades. It's not just at this moment. So I absolutely agree with Alan. You look at what the Democrats are probably going to pass with Lieberman's support, and maybe we'll see a few Republicans jumping on board. And I look at that, and then I project out 4 or 5 decades, knowing the dynamics that we've seen in other countries. And let me give you an example. In Britain, in the mid-19th century, 1800s, the labor unions got into a war to recruit members to the different trade unions. And what they offered was a benefit known as a sickness benefit. If you got sick, you got paid part of what you missed. Now, there was fear after a while that the workers were taking advantage of that. So then they started providing doctor's visits to check that the guys weren't just hung over, that they really were sick. Once the doctors were visiting, they started providing some kind of health care. Now, that system grew, and, you know, kind of like what we've seen with the bubble recently with the mortgages, it overgrew, and the labor unions promised too much. That system of sickness benefits went into bankruptcy, and then you saw the government stepping in to provide health insurance, which really was a kind of subsidy to that health insurance industry for those workers, not for the mother or the kids. That system itself began to collapse, and that's when you saw the government step in the 1940s and provide an actual socialized medicine system where the government paid the doctors a salary and the hospitals. So I look at this system with the individual mandate, with the tax subsidies, with the new rules of the road for the health insurance system, and with some understanding of the dynamics that's going to go on, in 4 or 5 decades, that will expand, and the government's role will expand. And eventually the government's control over spending, because it's going to be responsible for that, will also expand. So, you know, maybe, you know, we'll look at this in 4 or 5 decades and come to a very different conclusion and say, looks more like a single-payer system. Hmm.
But Professor Jacobs, it's already been 4 decades since the passage of Medicare, and here we are in 2009, and we can't expand Medicare. I mean, how long? We're talking about 100 years since that all started, if we finally get more people included in health care. That's a long time.
It is. And, you know, if you look at Medicare, it's a larger program than what was anticipated. And I think if you look at the entire kind of federal government involvement, it's larger. Medicare now has more benefits, including the drug benefit, which, by the way, this was passed by President Bush over the opposition of Democrats. And now Democrats are back expanding that benefit, which is exactly the kind of dynamics that will certainly take place once this is passed. So you've got a new benefit in Medicare. You've got new population groups. We've got the government stepping on a bipartisan basis about a decade ago to create a health insurance system for children who were in poor families. So, you know, there is a kind of a general expansion of the government's role in providing health insurance. It has certainly not been as fast or as comprehensive as Medicare's original reformers hoped for. But there is a kind of a pattern to it. And I think what we're talking about today in some ways is an extension of that vision that Medicare's reformers had back in the 1950s.
Nancy from Minnesota. Hi, Nancy.
Hi. I don't even know where to start. Listening to the conversation, I keep thinking, oh, that applies to me, that applies to me. And yet, I feel so insignificant, like none of it applies to me because it's all dealing with things down the road or in the future. I recently lost my job. I am a divorced 56-year-old woman who up until now owns my own home. I'm not sure how long that's going to be able to continue with no income. I have no savings. Mm-hmm. I drive a 1994 Jeep with 210,000 miles on it. I was able, while working full-time, to make ends meet. I was able to pay all my bills. I've never been late with a house payment. I don't have credit card debt, or a lot of credit card debt anyway. But now, with no income. I mean, in a matter of weeks, everything is piling on top. My insurance stopped. They actually canceled my insurance effective the 1st of December, even though I didn't lose my job till December 3rd. I take antidepressant medication, and I'm out of that, and I don't have insurance to cover it.
Oh, Nancy.
I don't know. I mean, am I just going to be one of those statistics? Am I going to lose my home? I was in the process of trying to refinance it and to get the payments lower. Although, like I said, I've never missed a payment, never been late with a payment. Well, of course, now the refinancing fell through.
How hard will it be for you to find another job, Nancy?
I don't know. In this situation, it was an unskilled job. I've put in a couple applications, a couple places, and nothing. I haven't even gotten a call back or anything. And the truth be told, right now, I don't even have it in me to go apply. I mean, who the hell wants to hire a 56-year-old woman?
Somebody might, Nancy. You're not that old, believe me.
I live in the country, and I have animals, and right now, my chickens, I sell eggs. I don't know.
My
car's going to die any day. I don't have reliable transportation, and there's certainly no way of replacing it. It's like, in all truth be told, it feels extremely hopeless. Like, there really is, I mean, what can possibly, I'm going to get this wonderful job that's going to come along, and I don't know.
Yeah, just don't go away, Professor Jacobs. Give her some hope if you can, please.
I don't think there is any hope out there.
Yeah, Professor Jacobs.
Well, you know, you're in a difficult situation, and I think a lot of us feel terrible about this. But here's what I would say. The economy is clearly, it's bottoming out. It's not going to get worse, or at least much more worse. And we are starting to see in a lot of different areas things starting to pick up. Let me just give you one example. If you've been in a store, you know, you'll see that what's on the shelves is not as much as you might expect, particularly for this time of year. And that is a very powerful signal of what a lot of different kinds of economic data are showing, that the retailers have not been keeping their inventory up because they weren't sure how much consumers were going to buy. They've now run out of that. They need to start restocking. And that means that they're going to be putting in more orders, which means that the companies are going to have to be bringing people back. So I don't know when, but I am confident that the job situation is going to improve. You should be looking into unemployment insurance. That can provide a variety of different kinds of benefits. In addition, this health reform plan that's being pushed through, one of its most impressive, and again, not talked about, but impressive benefits is to expand Medicaid to all individuals. Not just the families with kids. So that's something that, you know, you should keep a close eye on. And the most important thing is, you know, keep at this. A sense of, fatalism is not what you need right now. You need to kind of buck up and hang in there and know that a lot of us are pulling for you.
Right. And that a lot of people are in your situation, unfortunately. Maybe we don't pay enough attention to it, but there will be something for you, Nancy, if you're a hard worker. You're not that old. People will hire a 56-year-old woman. Believe me, I know that's true.
Isn't the Medicare thing the thing that Lieberman just blocked?
No, that's Medicare. That's a different program. Medicaid is meant for folks who have lower income. And up until this point, it's been really pretty restrictive. But this is one of many, many different parts of this reform that are kind of breakthrough elements. But it's now going to be expanded, quite a bit in terms of income and then who's eligible. So that's something to look to.
Oh, in the future, right, down the road.
It is down the road.
And the company that I work for is trying to block me from getting unemployment.
Well, fight them on it.
You've got to fight them.
You got to fight
them. There's only so much you can do there, too.
No, you got to fight it.
I will.
You got to get your
britches on. And I've been positive. I really have. This happened about 3 weeks ago, and I've really stayed up until just this weekend. I think bills came in the mail and my insurance is due and all that stuff. And it's like, there's no way I can pay it. And it just kind of all of a sudden all piled up. And Up until this weekend, I've actually done really well at staying positive and thinking, you know, this is going to end up a good thing and I'll end up better off than I was before and all that. But all of a sudden, it's not feeling quite so much like a positive step.
Churches and other organizations are providing counseling mm-hmm. and can help you with the unemployment insurance. If you've been a long-time worker, you can't be denied this.
Right.
So you got to fight that and fight it vigorously.
Right.
And there's help out there for you.
Yeah. So go fight it, Nancy. You'll find something. You'll find something. It may take a little while, but you'll find something. And I guess Nancy just typified the incredible struggle that many people are going through right now. That's just not right. Thank you, Nancy, for your call. I feel like you ought to call us back and let us know when things get better for you. We are pausing for a moment. We'll return. Professor Larry Jacobs is our guest here on the Ideas Network for the first hour of our program, Chair of Political Studies and Director of the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance at the Hubert H. Chumphrey Institute and Department of Political Science at the University of Minnesota. 800-486-8655 is the number. The email is talk@wpr.org. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program today, we'll be speaking with the author of Eating Animals. All right, let's go back to phone calls. Mike from Oshkosh is next. Hi, Mike.
Yeah, good morning, Kathleen. Unfortunately, there's millions of people in Nancy's position, and frankly, it's not going to change until the two sides, Democrats, Republicans, stop sniping at each other. And I'm sure the guest knows that we're really not going to solve this thing until we can address the underlying deficit debt issues connected to this problem. And Medicare, unfortunately, is driving, Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, driving this problem. So Lieberman's actually doing us a favor in preventing even more of the issue to be dumped onto Medicare. Medicare is underfunded by $40 trillion already. We simply can't add more people to it until we fundamentally change the way that we structure Medicare. And really the only way to do that is to get a commission, because everyone knows that the two sides aren't going to allow any substantial progress on addressing these problems until we can actually just remove the politics from it and get it into a commission, actually address the underlying problems. And really, when they do that, they're going to recognize that single payer is the only system possible that can both really reduce cost and cover everyone. So for Nancy and people like her around the country, we ought to be thanking Lieberman and hoping that this current effort fails, because this thing is a joke. It just bends the cost curve. It doesn't address the real problems. Single payer is the only way to go, and a commission is the only way to get to it.
Professor Jacobs.
That's a lot there. Just in terms of Medicare and the healthcare system, when you look at the inflation, that is the growth in healthcare costs, Medicare has been consistently more effective at controlling healthcare cost increases than the private sector. And the reason is because Ronald Reagan in the early 1980s put in place a payment system that restrained the cost on hospitals, and it was expanded to doctors, and then it was expanded later to outpatient services. So Medicare has actually, frankly, had a reasonable record on cost control. And one of the main ideas that's been shot down has been to establish an independent commission that would set Medicare reimbursement rates. Now, that program has put the fear into the providers, as we talked about earlier, because it would restrain spending, and it would help to sustain Medicare. Now, just on this point about single-payer, there are a lot of single-payer advocates who are big supporters of Medicare and viewed this expansion of Medicare to those 55 as a step in the direction of single-payer, because, Medicare system applies to everybody, past 65 years old. If you can start expanding that to the whole population, it's only kind of a little skip, and you can kind of bring in different population groups, and you're heading in the direction of a single payer. So for Mike, he might want to kind of think through Medicare as a kind of a stepping stone.
Mm-hmm. And thanks for the call. We are almost out of time. We never got a chance to talk about your teaching with Vice President Mondale, but that'll be fun, won't it?
It'll be great. You know, I only recently got to know Vice President Mondale. This is our fourth course together, and it's a fabulous course. We look at the battles that the presidents have had on national security and the tension with the Constitution. We look at three Republican and four Democratic presidents, so it's really... It's a very bipartisan approach. Mr. Mondale is a very rare combination of real-world politician and someone who has been reading and thinking about the Constitution for decades and decades.
That's the best combination. Thank you, Professor Jacobs, so much for being with us this hour.
Wonderful to be with you.
Our guest this hour, Professor Larry Jacobs, Chair of Political Studies, Director of the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance at the Hubert H. Humphrey Institute and Department of Political Science, University of Minnesota. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, to John Treader for on-air production in our Milwaukee studios. News coming up, and we have more conversation ahead.